Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kowalczyk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it is talking about the unseen aspects of our sex culture or using energy psychology to change the world to living through a civil war. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, Anessa Anderson returns with an interview with local guide and teacher Helen McConnell. New contributor Kona Hall shares reflections on living in and leaving Liberia. Kristen Thiel introduces us to two women leaving their marks on the world. But first, Lady Monte returns with Permutations. Today, she interviews a sex doula, Evian Whitney, on what it takes to dissect and articulate unseen aspects of our sex culture as a professional. The unpack common narratives which we tell ourselves about sex, examine where these stories about ourselves are born from, and discuss moving forward through discomfort to reach new heights of sexual attunement with our higher selves.
Thank you for joining us for another installment of Permutations, the show where we examine the nature of sex culture from the perspective of somebody with mutated sex chromosomes, otherwise known as intersex. I am your host, Lady Monte. For this episode, I sat down with somebody who dissects and articulates the movable parts of our sex culture professionally. Evian Whitney is a local writer, performance artist, business owner, and sex doula who uses her understanding and insight on this topic to coach others on their journey to liberate the sexual being within themselves. We discuss what has shaped her experience from spirituality, her history, and her community, and what supports her expression now as a woman on a journey of her own to become sexually liberated. What has shaped your sexual identity? What has shaped your sexual experience and brought it full circle around until being a professional coach and a professional doula, sexuality doula?
Oh, so many things have contributed to that. So I was raised pretty religious, Christian. I found that the things that I was coming up against when it came to reading about sex and sexuality, it got in there somehow through the things that I was witnessing, the things that I was watching, and also the things that I was hearing from my friends at the time, you know, talking about their own sexual experiences. I didn't really get this sense that women were actually enjoying sex. It was more so that they were put on this earth to be objects of pleasure and desire for men. So based on that, I assumed that the women who did have really great sex and who were able to enjoy having sex like a man, they were a very special kind of woman. Like, they were rare. I would definitely say just being able to have the awareness and understanding that I am a sexual being was huge for me, because for so long I didn't think that I was one. Mm-hmm. I thought that that was something that was segmented for a special class of person.
Right.
I jokingly would tell my girlfriends at the time, like, chocolate cake over sex any day. Being able to, like, ditch that narrative and that story that me as a woman, I am automatically sexually frigid. I was just done feeling the way that I was feeling. Mm-hmm. I was tired of feeling broken. I was tired of feeling like sex was difficult and hard and unattainable for me. I think I woke up one morning and was just like, I want to change this. I don't know what it's going to take. I want to, like, step past these boundaries. And so the process of that looked like me thinking about ways, like, what would it look like if, like, that's, if I didn't believe that? Like, what would it look like if that story wasn't true? How would I act? Who would I be? Yeah.
Image creation.
Yeah.
With that imagination, what sort of expressions did you have? Did you already have a sexual partner when you started envisioning yourself in this way?
Yeah, I did. I was, at the time, I was married for about, I think, 3 or 4 years at the time. And so, and my relationship with him was sort of swallowed up. That was also another reason why I felt really called to figure this stuff out, because I think there was certainly a part of me that was really wanting to do this on my own, but I felt even more of a precedence to do it because I knew that my own disconnection was affecting my partner, who I really loved.
What sort of things changed in your life besides your relationship with your partner, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
When you took this very personal expression and decided to become vocal about it, decided to become expressive about it.
One thing that I did as a way to chronicle my journey was I began writing on my blog, which is sexloveliberation.com. And I found that the responses that I got from people were just so they were so full of empathy. Like, people really understood where I was coming from because so much of their experience was very similar to my own. It can feel like you were literally the only person on the world that's dealing with it, especially when you see other people who are like, I'm having amazing sex.
Yeah.
It's so carefree and orgasms are plentiful and all those things. So it was really, really cool for me to connect with people in this way. And I mean, it was hard, of course, because there was a lot of vulnerability that was being shared on my part, and recognizing too that this is a widespread problem. Like, this isn't something that is an isolated event to just me, but there are dozens, if not thousands, of women out there who are dealing with the same kinds of stuff that I was dealing with at the time. So that response was really cool. It made me feel less alone. It made me feel like I had a community of people who were not only understanding where I was coming from, but also championing my own sexual awakening, my own sexual liberation.
Wow.
The other piece was more so like on a personal level. I've been writing for forever, like pretty much since I was 7 years old. And so my family has been pretty involved in that process. I've had a few digital blogs over the last several years. My parents and my family, they would read the blog. And so they thought, oh, this is another blog that Evian's doing. We'll just read that. And so me coming out as a sexual person who is also speaking very openly about how religion has like me over.
Wow.
In the way that like I see myself as a sexual being. I mean, my parents were not pleased.
Yeah.
They were very, very upset with the way that I was putting myself out there. And I even remember my father saying to me, like, by what you're writing, you're helping lead people astray. Like, the content that I'm putting out is creating this, you know, sin, or making people think bad thoughts or impure thoughts and lust and things like that. So it was a very strange thing to be like having both of those things happen at the same time, like feeling so much positivity, feeling like I was held by a larger community, and then also feeling like I was totally going against everything. And I was going against everything
right.
that I was taught.
Yeah.
It took some trial and errors, but I think my family, and particularly my mom and my dad, realized that like this was something that I was doing now, and the feelings that they were feeling, the triggers that were coming up for them, it was on them to handle those things. And for them, what they did was they just stopped reading. Yeah, they were just like, this is too much for me. I don't know what to do with this. So I'm just not going to read your work. And so, which is, you know, I think for a little bit, I allowed myself to get really upset about it and feel isolated and like, oh man, why can't I have parents that understand me and love me? And why can't I have sex positive family members? But I'm realizing that like, I'm on my own journey. I can't control or get them to be in a place where they don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so the most that I can do is just continue to shine my light. And every so often, my mom will ask me certain things about my sex life or about the work that I do. And funnily enough, I actually had her on my podcast.
And from this following, which you've created over the last 7 years, what would you say is the most pervasive issue within our sex culture, within the people who listen to your materials online, your podcasts, and maybe like buy your books?
Mm-hmm.
What's the one thing that you hear the most often that people come to you and want to engage with or move past, whether they're clients of yours or questions being written in?
I think the most common for me is the one that I hear the most is people just wanting to be able to express themselves as sexual beings in whatever capacity that looks like. That could be like in a kinky way, that could be in a vanilla way, that could be in a solo poly kind of way. They want to be able to express themselves sexually without inhibition, without shame, without guilt, and they don't know how to do that. The one thing that I say to my clients all the time who come to me and are like, I don't know why I have such issues with sex. Like, we have progressed so far in like this whole sex positive movement. And I always tell them, like, sure, there is sex positivity. And like, yes, we've made a lot of progress, but we still live in a sex negative culture.
Right.
And those messages, even if we're not directly paying attention to them, like, they still get in and they're still leaving impressions on us. So I always tell my clients, like, don't be too hard on yourself about about this. I'm kind of woo-woo in that I believe that those things that our great-great-grandmothers were taught about sex and sexuality, like, come with us as a package, you know? And a lot of what my work looks like is liberating the person that comes to me and also thinking about the women that I'm liberating as we're doing the work together, like the many other women that came before her in that way.
Especially in a capitalistic culture, consumerist culture, where we see sex for sale so often on so many different levels, which is good or bad. It's capitalism, right? And sex is a commodity because people want it. Obviously, though, being able to have a financial commercial exchange is not everything in this life. Is there a spiritual expression that you use that supports your new ideology around sex?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's so interesting. Like, and that was a question that that came up a lot for me. Like, if my Christian upbringing wasn't the best fitting when it comes to me being able to be a fully sexually expressed being, what sort of spiritual practice would instead, or what kind of relationship do I want to have with God if I do believe in that? I am still figuring that out.
Yeah.
Because I recognize that in most spiritual religious belief systems, there are parts of like the patriarchy and racism and sexism and misogyny. And so it's been very difficult for me to like find something that hits all of those for me, that makes me feel liberated. I wouldn't say that I'm 100% atheist. I mean, I am definitely exploring and have found resonance with thinking about my ancestors, and particularly like Afro-Indigenous spiritual practices. That's something that has been really inspiring to me, this idea of like who were my people before colonization? Like, who were my people and what did they think about sex and sexuality before colonization, before slavery, before being indoctrinated into a religion that didn't belong to them?
Right.
I don't really have the answers to those things because slavery.
Yeah.
But I'm allowing myself to dream, and I'm allowing myself to play with this idea of being my ancestors' like wildish dream.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you are a sexually liberated woman now.
Yeah, I'm trying to be. I mean, one thing that I like to tell people is that, like, I'm not an expert. Like, I'm still learning and going on my own journey. There's so many parts of me that still need to be healed. There's so many parts of me that still need to be discovered and given permission to be expressed.
With the healing you've done and the self-awareness you've created, what are the top five most important things for you to hold as far as identities, practices in your day-to-day life that support your sexuality and support your expression?
Affirmation is really important. So affirming that I am a queer woman of color, like a queer Black woman, is super important to me. Affirming that I am non-monogamous, and I'm non-monogamous because I really value my queer identity, and I recognize that being in a relationship with a cis dude is not going to allow me the luxury of liberating that part of my identity. I also get really fed by the work that I do. I use my clients kind of as mirrors. They're a way for me to check my own sexual traumas, check my own hangups that I have around being a woman, having this particular body, living this particular experience, and remind me that like this is like sexual liberation is a journey. It's not a destination. And then also just reading a lot of books.
Staying current.
It's super important to like feel the fear and do it anyway. That's the one thing that keeps me doing the work that I do and going up on stage, is remembering that the next day, even if it was a total fail, I would still feel really proud of myself at the end of the day. That's what I love.
So working through your fear, you've come to recognize as an emotional investment in your future self.
Exactly.
Hey.
Exactly. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do things that your future self would like be grateful for. It's
right,
like
on
the way that I kind of look at it.
Cool. Yeah. Let's all impress ourselves.
Yeah. Let's push our edges.
You mentioned a selfie workshop that you'll be teaching in March. Do you see taking selfies as more practice of creating sexual images of yourself?
Absolutely. Okay. And that's exactly why I created this workshop, because I can't be a sexually liberated woman if I don't see myself as one. How can I affirm myself as a sexual woman? And so selfies are like the easiest thing cool. to do. It was something that I was doing anyway. And I was like, what if I like made it more of like an erotic sort of sexual kind of thing. And yeah. so that's how my class was born. The class is called Sexting Myself, and it's going to be at Una Gallery on March 11th from 12 to 2 p.m.
Thank you so much for being in the studios
thank
today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
It's been a pleasure. To worship your own incarnation of embodied sexuality is a leap of faith. So how do you affirm that vision of divinity in your life? Our spiritual practices and community structure so much in how we imagine ourselves and our roles in society, and yet we don't always get the choice handed to us to choose which spiritual practices we will participate in or which defines us. From this interview, I learned that the practice of holding the image of myself, whether it is in the mirror or in a selfie picture, as happy, sexually fulfilled, and liberated is a key investment that my future self most likely will appreciate. More from Evie and Whitney, including their blog, links to their books, podcasts, can be found at sexloveliberation.com. My name is Lady Monte. If you enjoyed this program, you can find more of my collected works at l-productions.org. This has been Permutations. Thanks for listening.
To learn more about Evie and Whitney's work, visit kbu.fm and search for Politics of Living, Episode 13. We have a link to her website on our show page. Helen McConnell is a guide, a teacher, and a mentor, a true triple threat. Helen recently published her first book, 10 Simple Things You Can Do Now to Profoundly Change the World. Anessa Anderson and Helen talked about a healing modality called tapping, something she describes as energy psychology, and it's an essential tool for living.
Let's talk about tapping as a thing, because you're taking it out into prisons and, mm-hmm. you know, you're helping people resonate with it, with tapping. But I think that we should talk about what tapping is, because you found it for you.
Well, I still say to this day, I remember where I was and about when it was, but it found me. I mean, it came through the internet. I got an email about it and I watched a video. So
what is tapping? Let's start with tapping.
Tapping is a modality, a healing modality that falls under the category. There actually is a category of energy psychology. I would say it's 21st century psychological, emotional healing, true healing, because it works with tapping works with your conscious mind, which is what psychology works with. Tapping also immediately works with your subconscious mind, which psychology sort of does, but it's so much easier to access your subconscious mind when you're tapping. Tapping is sort of an offshoot of acupuncture. The points that we tap on the body with our fingers are acupuncture meridian points, but you don't need any needles. We just need to stimulate those points. So what we have discovered scientifically, which we always knew anecdotally, is that we being the tapping world, is that tapping calms the amygdala, which is the...
Amygdala.
That's part of the brain, okay. Right in the center of your brain, where it's like the first part of the human brain, you know, is the earliest brain development.
Uh-huh.
Our earliest ancestors had an amygdala, but it's a little walnut-shaped thing in the middle of our brain, and it's where fight or flight resides. And we needed that to survive, that fight or flight response. If in case we needed to run away from a predator or something dangerous.
Right.
That's how we've survived as humans. So what apparently happened as we began to get different parts of our brain where we could think and worry and stuff is we would be in fight or flight mode way more often than we need to be. That's why modern people are so sick, I believe, so diseased. We have, most of our disease is stress related. Now, I'm not putting doctors down, and I know there'll be people saying, no, that can't be true, but I believe that's true, that 95% of all disease is stress related. So stress comes in lots of different forms, and I also, tapping is great for our belief system. If we have a belief system that isn't serving us, and I'm not saying your belief in God, but more like your belief in I get the flu every year. If you believe that, it's most likely going to come true.
Yeah.
Because that's how powerful our mind is. And not just the flu, but other things. We believe a lot of things that aren't good for us. And when we believe things, and I mean believe at our subconscious level, But you hear people talking about it. I always get the flu, people might say. Right. Well, me personally, I never get the flu. I don't get sick very often. It's pretty rare that I get sick because many years ago, I realized that I was that powerful. Stress uses up all your natural resources for your immune system and for fighting disease and for keeping your body flexible and healthy. So if you can release that stress, which tapping is the best thing I know to release stress, you're going to have a much smoother ride. There are 9 sort of basic tapping points, which I can describe real quickly.
Sure.
So if people are listening and they don't know what they are, you can tap along. You can learn this yourself. I teach it to 2-year-olds. They know how to do it. You know, anybody can learn.
Yeah.
Anyway, they start on the top of the head, right in the center. If you're tapping right in the middle of your head, I think because it's so accessible, people think it's woo-woo and fake, but it's not. It's very real.
And then there's this one that's
inner
right
eyebrow.
Between the...
Well, it's actually on the inner eyebrow. It's where your brow ends. So it's one side or the other, essentially. But but you can tap on the middle. It's okay. Mm-hmm. That's how forgiving tapping is. Then you go to the side of the eye, right where your eye... What would you call that? Right at the corner of your eye, outer corner of your eye.
Yeah.
But you don't poke yourself. And this is all very gentle. Then you go under your eye, right in the middle, under your eye.
Uh-huh.
Under your nose, right between your nose and your upper lip.
And then below your lip.
Below your lower lip. We call it the chin point, but it's not really on your chin. It's just above your chin. Then we go to your collarbones, and it's a little bit below your actual collarbones, but anywhere close there is good. And then under your arm. We are made up of energy, and I think most everybody kind of understands that now, even though we're physical beings.
Mm-hmm.
At the deepest level of who we are, or the deepest level of anything physical, is energy. And in our human body, the ancient Chinese knew that we had meridians. That's where this all comes from. It turns out, scientifically, we now prove that the ancient Chinese medicine was correct. The meridians are energy sort of patterns. Mm-hmm. Energy movement goes up and down the body.
Right.
And then we have chakras that go around the body. But with tapping, we use these meridians. We base it on the meridians. And so if we're stressed or upset, or especially if we have trauma, that energy that's supposed to be going up and down the body kind of gets stuck and stalled and stopped. And that's where disease and pain and lots of other things start to happen in the body. The body is meant to be vibrant and healthy. It knows how, if we could sort of leave it alone, or, you know, if we, what I say to people is, if you could allow emotions of any kind to move through you rapidly, we would just have so many fewer problems. But we don't. We hang on to emotions. We remember things from our childhood. And the cool thing about tapping is it works with the body. We store all this stuff in our body and our subconscious mind. I'm not sure where one starts and the other one ends. But tapping helps us release all this stuff from our body. Whereas traditional talk therapy helps you sort of work things through in your mind. But it doesn't take, usually, sometimes it happens, but it doesn't take care of dissipating things out of the body.
How did you come to discovering this?
I always say that tapping and I found each other. It's sort of like we fell in love at first sight.
Mm.
Tapping came to me in an email. I remember where I was. I tapped along with this. It was a video link, and I tapped along with it, and I thought, I don't know what's going on, but I can feel something shifting. I wanted to be the person I knew that I could
that
be.
That you could be.
Mm-hmm. What I like listeners to understand is that what we're talking about here is the basics of tapping. And tapping is a powerful, powerful tool. So this is like if you were building a house,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't do it with just a hammer.
Right.
And tapping is both the hammer and the skill saw and the nail gun and the lumber. I mean, you can do everything with tapping. And that's why people don't believe that it works, because it does so much. But it works on the energetic level with emotions, with old thought patterns. And in the hands of a skilled practitioner, which I consider myself, we can do amazing things with tapping. I mean, I have helped people resolve deep, deep trauma.
So if I were going to come to you and say, help.
Help, yeah.
What would be the first thing that you would do for me?
First, I would talk to you about, what does help mean to you? You know, and most people have some idea of what they want to change in their lives. And then I would say, for, are you willing to do the work? Because I can't do it for you. I am
right.
The guide. I'm the guide,
right?
And the teacher, and the mentor. But you still have to do the work. And I think a lot of times in our modern society, we want to go somewhere and get fixed.
Yeah, well, we want to wake up the next day and feel like, oh, I'm all good now.
I'm all good now. And I tell people, if that's the case, you need to go find somebody else. Because after one session of tapping with me, oftentimes people will feel better. And I say feeling better is great, but feeling great is better. And feeling great is much more deeper. And feeling better is good. But why stop there? That's what we've always done. Feeling better is comfortable. And feeling great requires digging deeper.
With tapping, you've moved into a special place. You've gone into prisons?
Yes, I have taken this to the men's prison in Salem, and I'm...
Tell me how you moved into that area.
When I first started tapping and getting trained in tapping and practicing, I realized that this was, like I said, a really powerful tool, and I have visions. I still offer to go lots of places. I mean, I've been lots of places with tapping.
Yeah.
I have a client who volunteers in the prison and has for many years. And so she asked me, would you be willing to bring this into the men's penitentiary? As soon as she asked, I said, yes, they're going to put me in the safest possible situation in the prison. When I go there, I'm not in the cell block. I'm in a special room, a meeting room.
Yeah.
And the first time I went, it was truly life-changing because there were 60 or 70 inmates, men inmates, in this room. They're all in chairs and I'm in front of them all thinking, oh my goodness, I'm a little uncomfortable here. I wasn't scared, but I was uncomfortable. And you know, I got to tell you, those guys, they tapped along. They loved it. They can't wait for me to come back. You know, and I'm putting together a program so that I can go on a regular basis to go help these guys find themselves. Do you know, there are a lot of people in prison who made one mistake. And I've made lots of mistakes, you know, and these guys don't know what to do with their emotions. They were never taught what to do with their emotions or how to have emotions or how to forgive themselves or ask forgiveness or forgive other people. They don't know. They are just like sponges. That was one of the best audiences, one of the best groups of people I've ever presented to. So willing, so open, and so excited about having something. So that if they do get out, they'll have some tools. And if they don't get out, they'll have some tools. Tools for living. That we don't do that for our prisoners in this country. Probably most countries. But we tend to just throw them into prison and not give them...
Tools for a living.
Yeah, they need tools for living. Otherwise, they're just going to end up back there. It is the ultimate tool because you take it with you wherever you go.
Right.
It's easy to use. I mean, I've tapped in airports and I've tapped in the grocery store and... One of the best sort of side benefits that I've found for tapping is the spiritual growth that I've experienced. Not religious, spiritual. Where I really know how to forgive and love and stuff because I cleared all my crap, you know?
Yeah.
And that is a great gift. And really, that's the inspiration for this book that I wrote. But a summary of the book is, if you want to change anything in the world, I need to change me first. Each chapter has a thing you can work on and tapping instructions so you can really start changing that thing. Focus on what you're for, not what you're against. If we're angry at something that we're throwing vitriol at what we don't like, we're just adding to it. We're adding to the hate. So that's why I wrote this book with very, I think, fairly simple instructions on how to take care of 10 of what I consider to be common problems. And it starts with self-judgment. And so the first chapter is to stop judging yourself. Well, I've worked with hundreds, maybe thousands of people over the years. And if I ask someone, what does the voice in your head say to you when you make a mistake? What people tell me that the voice in their head says to them is really appalling, scary,
right.
Frightening.
Yeah.
I'm a horrible person. I'm a loser. I'm useless. I don't belong here. I don't deserve I don't deserve to be here. God hates me. My parents hate me. That kind of stuff comes out.
Right.
And so I want us to begin to treat ourselves as if we love ourselves.
Right. It comes from loving ourselves and then giving that love back to
everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Because the all the things that are going on in the world are just a manifestation of our collective being, you know, our collective emotions. If someone, this will be really controversial, but when there's a mass shooting of some sort, My first thought, I mean, I always feel bad, of course, for the victims and the victims' families, but I feel really bad for the person who perpetrated that kind of crime, because in order to inflict that much pain, you have to be in a great, great, great amount of pain for a really long time. So this is one of the reasons I'm going into the prisons, because I believe that the way to end crime is to end that pain.
And so what are you doing with going into prisons?
First of all, I'm offering the inmates some new thoughts. They actually have groups of men who come into a meeting room, a big
right.
meeting room, 60 oh. or 70 people. I'm not walking down what you see in the movies. You know, there aren't guys yelling through the bars or anything at me. It's a different situation than that. It's
right.
as controlled as a prison situation can be. And the men who come to this group, I think they're selected. I think they're regular members of this group. And there's a guard. Maybe more, I just noticed. I only noticed the guard that sits up here with me. I'm not the first one to take tapping into prisons, and I won't be the last. And
right.
tapping, we're taking, globally, we're taking tapping, and this is happening all over the world. We're taking tapping into prisons. We're taking tapping into schools. We're taking tapping into, my goal is to get out into some homeless communities and not to just come in and, you know, say, hey, I've got a better way for you to live,
yeah.
but to offer a tool that they can use under any circumstances so that if they do want to make a change in their life, they can. I don't force this on anybody. Mm-hmm. I also do a monthly meetup group, and I teach classes every week in tapping. So group tapping is really powerful. It's
so
a way
tapping again, to remind you, is that you're like...
Well, you can see all the actual tapping points. I like people to know the actual ones. And if you tap close to those, you're probably going to get the same result.
Right.
But I like people to know that I taught them the right ones. So, I mean, you know, the correct. It was developed from very specific acupuncture points.
Right.
So it's
an acupuncture point.
Mm-hmm. No needles, though, just your fingertips.
Right, fingertips.
And you can do it to yourself.
Right.
It's called tapping because it's actually was called emotional freedom techniques, but EFT is a confusing, you know,
right.
Set of initials these days. There's lots of things that are EFT. So we just say tapping. And it's becoming so mainstream. I mean, even outside of Portland, when I talk about tapping, people get it. They go,
yeah.
oh, yeah, I know
they
about
go,
tapping.
Tapping, yeah,
yeah
right, tapping.
Yeah. So I encourage people to try it. Mm-hmm. Try it on yourself first. Go online, find a video. You can go to my website, helenmcconnell.com, and find lots of, or go to my YouTube channel, find lots of tapping
right,
videos.
Right, right, right.
And at some point, your mind will not let you get past a certain point on working on yourself, I promise. Like, I have a client I worked with this summer who had been tapping for 2 years, and finally he called me. He said, I just can't get any further. And I said, that's because our subconscious mind won't let us get any further.
Really?
I work with a practitioner.
Really?
Yeah, that's the way we're built.
So where are you with tapping? You, Helen?
I'm not sure I know what I mean. What you mean by that. Where
well,
am I?
Well, I guess I would say, do you feel like you're like...
I'm an expert.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to say I'm an expert. I'm really good at what I do. I work with lots of different kinds of people on lots of different kinds of issues. I'm not afraid to... A lot of practitioners don't want to deal with trauma, especially intense trauma. I don't have a problem with that because I've done a lot of it, and I've cleared my own trauma. And so because I don't have that frequency in me anymore, I want you to imagine trauma living in your body like a buzzing.
Right.
Like a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And if you come in contact with someone else's trauma, it intensifies your buzzing.
Yeah. How should we start?
To tap?
Yeah.
I just say go with the basics. Just learn the tapping points and start noticing what it does for you. There's a little bit of a script that goes with it. We do use words generally, but it's not required. Many people tap with no words, but we like to, for people like me, I like to stay focused on what I'm tapping about, so I use words, and it helps me work
right.
with clients to use words.
Okay.
So we say things like, we start with the negative. We always start with, like, if you notice a sensation in your body that you call anxiety,
yeah, okay.
for example.
Okay.
I always suggest that you measure that intensity of that feeling right now when you think about the bill you have to pay or whatever, the thing that isn't really happening right now. And so say your intensity is at an 8 and you feel the intensity in your chest. You tap on the side of your hand, which is one of the points, and you say something like, even though I feel this anxiety at an 8, when I think about paying that bill, and then we usually add some sort of acceptance phrase, I accept myself completely. And we do that 3 times generally. Different practitioners do it different. And then you start tapping around those points that we talked about, the top of the head, and you just use a reminder frame, a reminder phrase, like this anxiety, and on the inner eyebrow, this anxious feeling in my chest, side of the eye, this anxious feeling under the eye, this anxious feeling under the nose, when I think about that bill, on the chin, this anxious feeling, collarbone, this anxious feeling, under the arm, this anxious feeling. You can be very repetitive. It doesn't really matter. You just do one round like that. It takes that 30 seconds. And then you check back in and notice, has it changed at all?
Wow.
And most people admit that it has changed. It's gone, yeah. Usually gone down, but sometimes it goes up, and that's okay too. We want it to change, though. We want things to start to change.
Right. So what do you, I guess, finally.
Yeah, it's hard. There's so much to talk about.
I know, but finally, I would say, what do you think the final thought is on tapping?
It's a game changer. It is a global game changer. Some of the most powerful spiritual people I know, some of the most powerful and educated psychologists and psychiatrists, some of the most brilliant philosophers are using tapping. So it's a game changer. It really is. I was speaking on Capitol Hill a few years ago, and I said, boy, if you could get me in front of the Houses of Congress, I would totally tap with them. And I know it would make a difference. I just think that that's how powerful it is. And it gives me the courage to stand up and speak. I used to be terrified to speak in public or to do this kind of thing. But tapping took all that away.
So I would say the final thing is, what do you think that you haven't done yet?
Oh my gosh, the list is so long of things that where I'm... 2018 is the year. I mean, it's already started to be quite a full year. I've got lots of things already scheduled and planned. In addition to taking tapping to the prisons, I'm just open to any place that wants to learn about tapping, and I'll go and teach it. Including, I wrote a letter to the mayor of Los Angeles, whose name is Eric Garcetti. He's a really interesting guy, and I offer to come and teach his staff how to use tapping for prisons, schools, and homeless, which are 3 of his big issues in Los Angeles. Haven't heard back, but those types of things. I'm not afraid to do that stuff. Big, bold, system-wide changes. It would work in a corporation. It would work in a small business. It changes mindsets. If you're stuck in just like, I can't make enough money, tapping can help you. Like, this is what I mean. Like, how do you explain in a very short time how tapping can help you make more money? But it does. It just helps you let go of all the ideas that you've picked up along the way that aren't true and aren't you.
So much food for thought from Helen McConnell, whose new book is out there right now, 10 Simple Things You Can Do Now to Profoundly Change the World. A little confession here. I'm a big, avid reader of books still, and I'm one of those people that likes to go to the end of the book to see how it ends, and go to the very end where she presents us with 4 exercises, and I wanted to read a little bit of the final exercise, which is you first identify your core values. There's a wonderful exercise that starts this list, like love and loyalty. And the last exercise is to take those newly identified values out for a spin. Helen suggests we write our 5 top values on a note card, look at the card each morning and throughout the day. Don't just look at the card, read the words and really feel into them. Are these values how you want to live your life? Do they reflect who you really truly are? As I said, so much food for thought. Again, thank you, Helen.
Kona Hall is a new contributor to The Politics of Living. She hails from Liberia and today shares her thoughts about living in the war-torn country. and her life experience shaped her into the person she is today.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining. This is Kona Hall, born and raised in Liberia. Today I'm here to share my story with you guys that are my experiences through the Liberian Civil War in 1989. The war started in 1989. I was just 9 years old. And went to the war until I was at the age of 10. I fled Liberia in 1990. My experiences through the war has pretty much molded me to be who I am today. So I have a bittersweet experiences through the war. So I'll start by saying I was 10 years old when the Civil War started in Liberia. And at the age of 10, what I saw and experienced was something that I wouldn't wish on anyone, especially not a 10-year-old child. I saw death, you know, I saw death very close up in my face many, many times. Seeing dead bodies of children, babies, old and young people, you know, it was such a horrific experience. And it's something that I just haven't been able to run away. And I tried, but it's something that I just can't run away from because it's such a huge part of mine growing up as a child. And, you know, the memories that have stayed with me throughout my adulthood and has molded me into the wife, you know, the mother and the woman that I am today. And to go through the struggles of finding food every single day, having to struggle to find shelter where I'm going to sleep for the night. You know, almost the entire year of being through the war was just a complete nightmare. And having to find food and not knowing where to find the food, first of all, because every store has been raided and everything is just destroyed. So end up eating, it's a food we call pankana. It's a little nut, it's a nut. And I have to crack this nut every day just to eat it, just to chew it. It's not even it's not something I can get full of, but at least I had something to eat for the day. So my experiences, it gave me the sense of how to create my own opportunities. I don't know if that makes sense, but I've learned through the war that I can make my own opportunities. Nobody have to make it for me. I have to create it myself. So over the years, moving to the United States at the age of 21, I had that passion that if I ever get the opportunity, the platform where I can go back or try to open, you know, a way to create opportunities for my fellow Liberians, I will always want to do that. And if I can share my story and it reach someone and inspire someone, I will also love to do that. And through this platform, I can share the story. And then I believe it's also therapeutic for me, you know, to get it off my chest and have someone else's hear it, you know, how it has inspired me. It not only broke me at the age of 10, but it inspired me because seeing so many destruction, so many dead people, so many children just crying and parents were not around, gave me a sense of purpose in life. You know, it molded me to always have that courage that if I can ever get out of this, I will have to come back here one day and help my people, or not even come back, but just find a way to help people, period. You know, it opened my eyes at a very young age to what life is truly about. And I realized that life is not about money. Life is not about, you know, all the good things we have around us. But life is also about being there for someone when they really need you and giving that time, you know, and that presence to them. And I've kept that throughout my years, you know, since the age of 10. And that has molded me to even be here today to share my story through my will to live and my will to survive and my will to create opportunities and my will to, you know, wanting to help people and make a better life for anyone if I can. And also the will for me to be grateful, very, very grateful when it comes to life and the opportunities that life brings along with me. So at the age of 10, the Liberian Civil War did not only destroy me by, you know, breaking my home, you know, turning me away from what I'm used to, my norm, but rather introduced me to a world of gunshots and bombing and starving and, you know, can't even take a shower. But today I'm here sharing my story, and I'm just trying to share that throughout the war, throughout the destruction, something molded me, something gave me a sense of purpose. And this is why I'm here today, to let everyone that's listening know, no matter what life throws at you, good or bad, always see the good side out of it, because it can mold you into someone bigger and someone better, and also give you a sense of purpose on how to appreciate the little things that we have today. So I'm very appreciative of my life. I'm very fortunate, and I don't take anything for granted. So thanks for listening.
Next up, Kristen Thiel shares this month's She-Ra Solution. It's a monthly biography of women past and present that was inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, that was published by The Atlantic. Today, she talks about two women who lived more than a half a century apart, but finally both joining their respective industry canons now, making history for women and African Americans.
In November 1943, a woman named Florence Price wrote a letter to the Boston Symphony Orchestra's music director. Hers was no average fan letter. She was in her late 50s. She was African American. And she had a personal appeal. Would this famous orchestra consider playing one of her compositions? Unfortunately, Price wrote to the music director, the work of a woman composer is preconceived by many to be light, froth, lacking in depth, logic, and virility. Add to that the incident of race, her letter continued. I have colored blood in my veins, and you will understand some of the difficulties that confront one in such a position. Price wrote two letters to the director, and it's not known that he ever replied to either of them. More than 70 years later, in 2017, the Boston Symphony Orchestra wasn't necessarily doing much better by Price. Challenged to diversify its programming, the BSO responded that that was not what its audience wanted. They actually did perform some Price music that year, but only with a string quartet in a community concert. Today, major American orchestras are not doing much better by any female composers in general. For example, both the Chicago Symphony and the Philadelphia Orchestra recently announced seasons with no female composers to be found in the lineup. I'm talking about Florence Price today because she clearly beat incredible odds. She would have even if she'd been working today, so she certainly did when she was alive and composing in the early 20th century. In an establishment that remains uninterested in composers who are not male and not white, Price accomplished something amazing when the Chicago Symphony performed her Symphony in E minor in 1933. This was the first time a major American orchestra played a piece by a Black woman composer. The road to further publication would remain uphill, as evidenced by her fruitless writing to the Boston Symphony Orchestra, but at least someone had taken a chance on her, in a big way. Price was born in 1887 in Little Rock, Kansas. Her father was the city's first Black dentist, and supposedly he was the governor's dentist. In secret, of course. Price excelled at the New England Conservatory, though she did so with her racial identity concealed. Price became an integral part of the response to composer Antonin Dvorak's call for an American art music to be built on African American idioms. George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue came out of this desire to create a uniquely American style. But while Gershwin's and other white composers' works became famous, so many Black composers, also putting new arrangements to old African-American works, did not. Price transformed spirituals with new arrangements, and she also sought to share a wholly modern African-American voice. Her Symphony No. 3 was meant, she said, to be, quote, Negroid in character and expression, though she did not intend to, quote, project Negro music solely in the purely traditional manner. None of the themes are adaptations or derivations of folk songs. The intention behind the writing of this work was a not too deliberate attempt to picture a cross-section of present-day Negro life and thought with its heritage of that which is past, paralleled, or influenced by contacts of the present day. Marquise Carter is a Price scholar who said that our understanding of American modernism of the 1930s and 1940s is incomplete without Price. Price's work answers an important question. Quote, Florence Price is a representation in music of what it means to be a Black artist living within a white canon and trying to work within the classical realm. How do we, through that, create a sound that sounds our culture, sounds our experience, sounds our embodied lives? Price composed until her death in 1953. and no one went looking for her hundreds of unpublished manuscripts until 2009, when they were found in her summer home outside of Chicago. Currently, the Fort Smith Symphony in Arkansas is working on recording her four symphonies and is scheduled to perform two of them in concert this summer. Also this year, another African-American woman made history in her profession, soaring far above the history books, rather literally. In February 2018, Tahira Lamont Brown became FedEx's first female African-American pilot. FedEx has been around since 1971. Like Florence Price, it was also born in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it has just now accepted its first Black woman pilot. Brown worked two jobs and borrowed money from her family to pay for college and flight training. She received mentorship from another trailblazer, Bill Norwood, United Airlines' first African-American pilot. Now, in her spare time, she mentors young people. She tells girls who want to be pilots, quote, "I let them know that I am here to support them, to give them advice and to listen to them, because that was important to me. But they will have to find it within themselves to know that is achievable." And it could be easy to get discouraged, Brown admits. Brown said, quote, "While I feel like I've accomplished a lot, I will not feel like I've made it until I see more minorities in the industry. When I speak at conferences, I help provide information about FedEx and encourage minorities to apply. However, I have not seen a significant change." I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and thanks to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Kona Hall, Anessa Anderson, and Lady Monte. Also, thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and our webpage manager, Vicky Mazzone. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchek. Have a great day.